Talk given Friday, 12th June, 1981. At our meetings in May, last month, we saw how our conditioning makes us unfree mentally to see truth, to investigate freely. This is the important point. All our conditioning makes us interpret everything that comes through our senses, that we read or hear, makes us interpret it in a particular way, which is not necessarily, in fact almost always, isn't a real understanding, a vision of the truth as it is. And this is particularly so where the religions of the world are concerned, as embodied in the scriptures. We are imprisoned in our concepts, and the words become fixations. We say that the scriptures are the word of God. They are the final truth. And right up to this day, we have fundamentalists all over the world. In each and every single religion, we have fundamentalists. They say this is the word of God and this is the absolute truth, the final word. But in saying this, we all forget that it is I, the person, the imperfect man, who gives meaning to the word. Even if we may assume, just for the sake of the argument, that the word is the word of the supreme deity or whoever it is, what was in the mind of the deity? What did he mean when he said something? And what do I mean by that same word? This is the great problem. And therefore, we must realize that as the centuries pass, the new word must of necessity come into being, because it is our conceiving and our verbalizing which undergoes change all the time. The truth will remain the truth, but everything else changes. Even our so-called scientific observations, they also undergo continual change with fresh instruments for observation, with advances in mathematics, and with advances in our knowledge of how our own minds work in relation to what is conveyed by the scientific experiment through our senses to the brain. Because of all that, we know that we cannot say that anything is the final truth of the matter. The concept and the word has no finality in it. It is a temporary thing. It belongs to the realm of mortality. So, there can never be any final statement of the truth, because of this constant change. What we can do is to see that this change is a progressive change. That is to say, progressive in terms of our capacity to see more and more clearly into the truth, and to express less and less inadequately that which we perceive. Our power of conceiving the fact and of speaking about the fact is the thing that grows through the centuries. So one has to bear that in mind where the study of religions and religious living and so forth is concerned. In fact, where our whole living process is concerned, we have to bear that in mind. This continuous change, that is the one changeless fact of the universal process, continuous change takes place. And we have to take that into account and go in line with the change that comes about. We can make that change, as far as we are concerned, regressive through our own foolishness, through our own faults, and so forth. But if we use our senses rightly, then we are likely to make the change in our the growth in our perceptions and the expression of those perceptions progressive, which means our growth as human beings. Consider this question of consciousness. We talk so often about the deep states of consciousness, about that final stage which a human being, constituted as he is at present, can realize. The state in which he is, as he says, at one, made one with transcendence. The Unio Mystica of the Christian mystic. The state of the cessation in Buddhist teaching. In the Hindu teachings, the Turiya, what they call the fourth state, which is perhaps best expressed in the Mandukya Upanishad. It's a very remarkable little Upanishad. It's only about 2 or 3 pages in print, no more. But it is a most remarkable Upanishad, which is called the realization of haurvatat, holiness, and ameritat, immortality, in the Zarathustrian scriptures. And in the Zarathustrian scriptures, these, holiness and immortality, are called the gifts of God, Ahura Mazda, to him who lives the righteous life. Righteous meaning not in our ordinary limited dictionary sense of the word, but the utterly pure life which is in harmony with the law of our being, the innate law of our being, Ritta in the Rig Veda, Asha in the Avastha. Those are the words which are used, you see. All right. Now we talk of that state as the profoundest state of consciousness. That by itself tends to be a slightly misleading statement about it. Because consciousness, as we experience it, as we know it, is discriminative consciousness. It is analytical. It separates all objects from us, the observer, the person who is conscious of it, and isolates us from all the living world. I am I, you are you, and everything else is just observed by me a separate observer. You see, this is the great trouble. This is, as you know, in the Buddhist presentation, we have the word vijnana, meaning discriminative consciousness. Now, this discriminative consciousness depends for its functioning upon the sense functions, the impressions which come through the sense avenues to the brain, where they are afterwards synthesized in order to make a meaningful pattern. But essentially, our consciousness of what we have experienced or seen is an analytical consciousness which breaks up the wholeness of existence. This has to be borne in mind, and that is the nature of consciousness in us subhuman, in our subhuman state. In the wholly human state, there is a change. What was intended to be presented by the Buddha, for instance, when he talks of the state of the cessation, which is the stopping of all feeling and perception. Note carefully, the words feeling and perception have to be understood in a transcendent sense, in a sort of a cosmic sense, not in the sense of the limited context of everyday affairs in the world. This is very important, you see. He called it the cessation of perception and feeling. And the Upanishads present the four states of consciousness, culminating in this Turiya, or the fourth state, which is the transcendent consciousness. But they use the word chit. Now, the word chit does mean consciousness, of course. It also means attentiveness, and so forth. But in all the religions and in all the mysticisms, this ultimate consciousness is presented as a complete unifying consciousness. Now, if it is a unified and unifying consciousness, it does not discriminate. It is not conscious in the way you and I are conscious. You are conscious of me talking here as a particular person separate from yourselves saying certain words, right? That is how you are conscious. But that sort of consciousness completely disappears, and there is only a kind of a general awareness. This is where the word awareness is a better word. If you talk to a psychologist or a scientifically minded person or a logician or anybody, he will not agree with me at all. He will say that this discriminative consciousness which we have, which can analyze and enable you to keep on talking and talking and talking about something, you see, is the sign of development and perfection and so forth. Not the least bit. This consciousness which becomes the unified awareness, you are just aware of the thing without any discriminative activity taking place. To take a concrete example, when I look at that piano, I am conscious of the piano. I know exactly what it is, what it does, what I can do with it, and so forth and so forth. I can tell you its color, I can tell you its weight, and so on, you see. So that when I am conscious of the piano, I am conscious of all the characteristics of that piano. Now, characteristics disappear in the supreme consciousness, which is this unified awareness only. It's not difficult to understand, but it takes time really to get at it. After all, it's taken me practically my lifetime to see this. In this unified consciousness, there are no, in this unified awareness, state of awareness, there are no characteristics as such. The Hindus use the word Atma to represent this type of consciousness. This, which they didn't call awareness, they called it consciousness, you see. And the Buddha used this long phrase, which I have repeated 100 times if I have repeated it once. Vijnanam, which is discriminative consciousness, Anidassanam, without characteristics, Anantam, without beginning, and therefore also without end, Sabbato, everywhere, Pahang, accessible, or Pabham, shining. Both words are used, Pahang and Pabham. Now, if it is a state of consciousness which has no characteristics whatsoever, you see, obviously all discriminativeness has disappeared. The unification is as complete as, to give a physical analogy, the unification of a drop of water which falls into the bathtub. Where will you find that drop of water again? And you know, the Upanishads always use this beautiful phrase, the river has entered the ocean. The river has entered the ocean. We know, because we are external observers, we know that the drop of water which fell into the bathtub is part of all the water of that bathtub. True enough. But even we, with all our wonderful scientific knowledge and so forth, will we be able to abstract that particular drop of water from the bathtub? We can't. It's gone, so to say. Now, this, of course, is the thing that repels the followers of faiths which are other than Buddhist and Hindu. They don't like it. No. Individuality, personality, the person continues forever and ever. Nothing. It isn't lost. This they equate this state with annihilation of the person, but there is no annihilation. It is a, if one reaches that state in when in one's own awareness, quiet, poised, peaceful awareness, one is aware of the complete relationship. And do remember, aware of the complete relationship, not in terms of concepts and descriptive words and so forth, but just aware it's there. You see? Like in ordinary life, one is suddenly aware of something. It's there. But what is there, you can't speak analytically. You see? If you realize that state, you will see that there is no loss. Because in the first instance, there was no new something which was me, which came into being and which could be lost. It was all there all the time. And it is all there all the time. Once there is an emergence of a real sense of transcendence, and this is one of the deep meanings of yoga and the practice of yoga, to let this sense of transcendence emerge, you see, to enable it to emerge by moving out of the way of the transcendent, not obstructing the transcendent. Once this sense of transcendence emerges, you are awake. Not only in terms of the finite, the temporal and the mortal, which is our everyday existence and life. But you are thrilling, you are throbbing in tune with the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And you begin to understand how to suggest in the language of the mortal that which belongs to the immortal. You remember that since last autumn we have been considering together a good deal in connection with the nature of eternity and so forth. And we saw fairly clearly that eternity is not the opposite of time, and nor is it to be identified with the timeless. Because time and timelessness both have meanings for us in the context of our ordinary everyday living process in time, in terms of a time consciousness. And there is the actual fact of time as such. You remember I suggested this idea to define time. Time is the rhythm of the living process of the universe. It's the rhythm of the living process of the universe. And a rhythm actually is something immeasurable. It is something which is outside the realm of intellect, but which is within the realm of feeling. You can feel a rhythm. You can sense a rhythm. But you can't intellectualize it. Then it just becomes the bus conductor's beat. You see? So, eternity subsumes both time and the timeless state too. Because the timeless state is a human experience which begins at a particular moment in time, lasts for a certain time, which may be as much as 7 days continuously and nights, as the Buddha said. It may be 7 days and nights, but after that you come out of it, you have to come out of it, if you are to continue to live as a separate human being. The body has to feed, excrete, and so on and so on, you see. Therefore you come out of it. So the experiencing of timelessness is a temporary stoppage of the experiencing of our living process as a movement in time. You get the idea? It's a stoppage of that, because time ceases to affect us when we are in that timeless condition. But the timeless must not be identified with eternity. Eternity in itself is, as far as I am concerned, still, I may perhaps change later on, is quite nondescript. I have no words for eternity but the word eternity. All I can say is that it subsumes time and the timeless and must not be identified with the timeless as such. So now, if this sense of transcendence begins to awaken, you will become aware in terms where the finite mortal world is experienced and understood, and also something of that immortal, infinite, eternal world is a reality for you. When I talk in this way, and I have no option but to talk in this way, one immediately thinks one may feel that I am presenting two different worlds, the finite and mortal, as contrasted with the infinite and immortal. That isn't the case. There is only one world. The separation lies in my consciousness. Nowhere else. You see? That piano as a finite, temporal, object which in course of time will perish. How many years it will take, I don't know. But in course of time it will perish. All right. That piano as that sort of object I am conscious of in finite terms, and I am also conscious of it in terms of the infinite and the eternal and the immortal. It's a curious thing. The two contexts begin not so much to blend, because then I'd be a perfected holy one myself, which please realize I am decidedly not. I'll tell you in a moment why and how. They're not a perfect blend yet, but there is a relationship. They play with each other in terms of actual awareness, you see. Now, if they become a blend, the two contexts in your own consciousness, it is our consciousness which is a divided consciousness. You see, it's a divider, and it is also divided in terms of the mortal and the immortal. Which, understand that, and you will quite understand why man seeks the immortal, or at least some men do. I don't suppose IRA does, but but some men do seek the immortal. They are aware of it they have an awareness of it in a peculiar way. They are not conscious of it, but they have an awareness of it, you see. They have it simply because this thing can happen, and one enters, that is to say, one emerges out of the limitations of one's mortal, finite state of consciousness, and that eternal, immortal state touches you in your state of mortality, which makes a colossal difference to you as a mortal, a colossal difference in so many ways. Now, how will you know that there has taken place the perfect blend which enables a Jesus to say, I and my Father are one, and which enables your yogi, your Upanishadic Holy One to say, Pratyagatma and Paramatma are one. Pratyagatma is represented by the word I, and Paramatma is represented by transcendence itself. What is the touchstone by which a person may know that this is so? The psychophysical being who is alive, the person whom we see, is one who is entirely free of any reaction which can be traced to the root of greed or hate or delusion or fear. Now, if we examine our own mental process as we live from moment to moment, I dare not stand up and say I am free from such reactions. You see? The perfected Holy One is one who is utterly free of all that. Remember Jesus' words, by their fruits ye shall know them. The way they behave and act and carry on in their worldly life will, if you have sufficient perception, you will see. This one is not yet the perfected Holy One. And when he is the perfected Holy One, this isolative and separative self-consciousness, which keeps him bound to the realm of mortality, will have completely disappeared in that state. So now, this state of consciousness, this profounder state of consciousness, is better called awareness. Something which doesn't divide, something which you know not in the ordinary sense of knowing a thing. What you know very well, you can describe in great detail, can't you? What you don't know so well, you can't describe in great detail. But this is the nature of the knowledge at the mortal, finite level. This other knowledge, which is the real meaning of the word vidya, as used in the Upanishads, of vidya, as used in Pali. The Sanskrit is vidya, the Pali is vidya, you see. This other knowledge is the realization, complete realization of that state of unified awareness. And that's the supreme knowledge. And because people do not have that knowledge, the Buddha said that ignorance, and that is what he meant by ignorance, the absence of that kind of knowledge, you see. Because of ignorance, there come into being all the different elements which compose, which are descriptive of the rationale of our mental processes. And our mental processes are the processes which spell sorrow and suffering, or a state of calm and peace and so forth. See, this has to be borne in mind carefully. So it is most worthwhile always to go more and more deeply into this and to realize that the word of scripture has to change. See, you know how, what a heretic I am. And radical. I'm constantly contradicting some of the old writings and the old explanations and so on. Simply because as you see a little bit more and more truly and deeply, then your power for conceptualizing what you see and verbalizing your conceptions grows. And therefore your words will be different. All right. Now, take another case. Happiness or joy on the one hand, bliss on the other. The dictionary will, of course, more or less say that they are all synonyms, different in degree, but not different in kind. Now, to speak quite accurately, the dictionary is right, because that is by common consent, they are treated as synonyms, equivalent to each other, by common agreement. But if you arrive at a state in your innermost being of the state of unified awareness, where the psyche has become utterly purified and mind in its transcendent nature and power is functioning freely through you, then you experience the real meaning of the Sanskrit word ananda. Sanskrit and Pali both have the same word. Ananda, meaning bliss. And the Varaha Upanishad, particularly, which is a very important Upanishad, states outright that the primordial creative energy, pure consciousness, of course it uses the word consciousness, chit, you see, not awareness, pure consciousness and ananda are an identity. Now, in this state of the unified awareness, the supreme realization that can take place through the purified human being. In this state of ananda, there is complete peace. There is poise. a poise which is so unshakable that that person is imperturbable under any and every circumstance. This imperturbability is an extraordinary thing. Even if one hasn't, I'm going to use the wrong word, achieved it, still, if one has gone some distance and has felt the touch of it, it is a blissful condition. There is no word in the English language which expresses the difference, nor is there a word in Sanskrit or Pali, because in Sanskrit or Pali, ananda is regarded as, excessive or supreme joy. Not excessive, but supreme joy. It has nothing to do with joy. It has nothing to do with happiness as we understand it, because joy and happiness are associated with, completely interwoven with, the functioning of our senses and the functioning of our brains as interpreters of what we experience. You see? The interpretative activity of the brain comes into play. And this is happiness or joy, mental joy. With the mind it is joy, with the physical body it is happiness, and so forth. And it is all related to sensation, to excitement, to pleasure, as we experience it and understand it. Now we know from our own experience, Without it being necessary for us to be perfected holy ones to see this, we know from our own experience that all sensational excitements, pleasures, and so forth, they are all temporal. They pass away. And then there is the craving to repeat the thing and have more. And if you don't get the craving satisfied, then you're miserable again about it. So both what the world calls joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain, both are always present as pain and sorrow in the ultimate. You see? Now if you see this, you'll truly begin to understand the meaning of dukkha, the word which is so prominent in Buddhist teaching, dukkha, the ill state. Because the Buddha and those like him, and there were several, he himself names 104 or 108 in one of the discourses, you see, because the Buddha himself realized this state of imperturbability, of complete peace, of absolute poise, which nothing could disturb, no sickness, no sorrowful news or anything like that could disturb that poise, therefore he knew bliss. You get it? Bliss includes pleasure and pain. It subsumes these. It includes joy and sorrow. It's the imperturbability and the sublime, unoriginated nirvana which is associated with this transcendent peace, the peace of God which passes understanding. Because that was a realized fact, therefore they spoke of ananda, bliss. So now, you see, these words all have different meanings. Happiness is necessary for the child and the childish stage. Joy is also necessary psychologically for the adolescent stage particularly. And then, if one outgrows all the deficiencies of the childish state and the adolescent state, and really is able to arrive at the truly human state, the happy creator. I use the word happy because language fails, this creative state, then there is the fulfillment of the person as a human being in the full sense of the word. So remember that pleasure and so on is associated with the psychophysical organism. It belongs to the realm of mortality. Bliss belongs to the realm of immortality. Now don't think, oh, forever and ever I shall be blissful. You will never be blissful forever and ever. It is the bliss of transcendence which will manifest through you, the perfected Holy One. You achieve nothing. The moment there is any consciousness that, oh, I am in the blissful state, you're suffering from a mighty illusion. Have a psycho-spiritual bath straight away. You see?